A piece of silver screen history is up for sale.
If I hadn't been very rich, I might have been a really great man.
That's Orson Welles playing Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane, now considered among the best movies of all time. But after its release back in 1941, Citizen Kane received just one Academy Award. That Oscar went to Welles and Herman Mankiewicz for Best Screenplay, and Welles' statuette is now on the auction block. This wasn't just the only Oscar that Citizen Kane won. It's the only Oscar that Orson Welles ever won. And then he misplaced it.
Yeah, it was lost for decades. And it wasn't until, after Orson Welles' death that it was actually recovered by the family.
Laura Eintema is the auction manager at Nate D. Sanders Auctions. She can't tell us who is selling the Oscar. But Orson Welles' daughter, Beatrice, won a court case a few years ago, giving her the right to sell it. The Academy frowns on this sort of thing.
Before 1950, those Oscars are the only ones that can be sold on the open market. After 1950, anybody that wins an Oscar has to sign an agreement that they can't sell it.
And that makes this sale even more rare. The auction house is hoping the statuette fetches $1 million, although so far,
I think the last bid when I checked today was approximately $80,000, and the auction ends in 1 week.
Perhaps a bargain for a piece of Hollywood once thought lost.
Rosebud.
Our program is directed by Greg Dixon, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. We had engineering support from Chris Nelson. At the Washington desk, Ron Elving, Beth Donovan, Neil Carruth, Kathy Shaw, Sharish Date, Evie Stone, and Kimberly Adams. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Cable TV these days is offering a new crop of some very popular characters who aren't exactly heroic. They aren't even necessarily good guys just acting a bit bad. They are meth dealers, serial killers. There's a murderous biker gang. And critic Eric Deggans is struck by the way audiences are responding to TV's anti-heroes.
Does this guy sound like a hero?
The bond that holds this club together isn't about love or brotherhood anymore. Fear and greed now.
That's Jackson Jax Teller, the anti-hero at the heart of FX's blockbuster biker gang series, Sons of Anarchy. Just this season, Jax blew away a rival gang with an RPG missile, shot a Russian gangster in the head, and
you guys are running coke for the Mexicans?
Got into some serious trouble while selling guns to the scariest gangsters on the planet.
Those guns are already sold! The cartel is expecting all of them in 2 days.
I get it!
Jax Teller is the leading edge of an increasingly extreme crop of anti-heroes, characters the audience likes and wants to see succeed, even though they act an awful lot like villains. The cable channel AMC has become a haven for anti-heroes, from philandering ad man Don Draper on Mad Men to the meth-making ex-school teacher Walter White on Breaking Bad. And their latest anti-hero, ex-Confederate soldier Cullen Bohannon, owns slaves. When it comes to bad guys doing bad things, you can't get much worse than that. So how does AMC's new series, Hell on Wheels, make a slave-owning anti-hero sympathetic? It makes the villains even worse. Bohannon is hunting down the Union soldiers who raped and killed his wife.
I am not proud of what happened to your wife, Bohannon.
Didn't happen to her. You did it to her.
In fact, Hell on Wheels uses race as a handy scorecard. The heroes resist prejudice and racism, while the villains wallow in it. And the anti-heroes can get even worse. Consider Dexter Morgan, a serial killer who only kills other murderers, on Showtime's hit series, Dexter.
People think it's fun to pretend you're a monster. Me, I spend my life pretending I'm not. What made me the way I am left a hollow place inside. So I become an expert at blending in, camouflaging myself.
Dexter may be TV's ultimate anti-hero, a murderer working as a forensic technician for the Miami police. Author Jeff Lindsay, who created Dexter in his crime novels, once told me he specifically built the character to draw an audience's sympathy. Dexter has a soft spot for kids, a strong moral code, and a license to do things the rest of us can only dream about. That's the last lesson in creating a great anti-hero. He or she often protects the innocent, even when they're dealing drugs and killing people. But these characters, warped as they can be, are also a statement on our times. In a world filled with war, recession, and cynicism, straight-up heroes feel fake as a $3 bill. So the confused guy who does bad things for the right reasons just might be the best reflection of where we are today.
Eric Deggans is TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. The movie Juno introduced audiences to a quirky teen. The title character was quick-witted and confident, even when faced with an unplanned pregnancy.
I could, like, have this baby and give it to someone that, like, totally needs it.
You should look in the Penny Saver.
They have ads for parents.
Yeah, desperately seeking spawn.
Juno also introduced screenwriter Diablo Cody. That mix of sass and sentiment won her an Oscar for Best Screenplay, the first she'd ever written. In her new movie, young adult, Diablo Cody is back in adolescent girl territory with a dark twist. This character is an adult who spends her life channeling a teenager as a writer of young adult novels. Mavis, played by Charlize Theron, has all the superficial trappings of a successful 30-something, an apartment in the big city, Minneapolis, slender skirts, high heels, a small dog, and lots of cocktails. She's also lonely, emotionally stunted, and ruthless. So much so, she decides happiness lies in returning home to steal back her high school boyfriend.
Here's the deal. Buddy Slade and I are meant to be together, and I'm here to get him back.
I'm pretty sure he's married with a kid on the way.
No, kid's here. I'm cool with it. I mean, I've got baggage, too.
I would keep all of this to yourself. I would find a therapist.
Diablo Cody joined us at NPR West to talk about her new movie, Young Adult. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Let's start with the character Mavis Gerry. Now, she's got a measure of success as a ghostwriter for a series of young adult novels called Waverly Prep. I mean, it's not exactly the Twilight series.
No, she's not. She hasn't set the literary world on fire, but she's from a small town, so she's relatively successful.
And at the point that we meet her, she doesn't seem to have ever grown out of her high school glory, whatever that glory was. She's very pretty, so probably prom queen or one of the popular girls. But we discover that she hasn't grown up when she gets this email that contains a birth announcement.
Yes. I mean, she was already pretty dissatisfied in her life. But the trigger that really sends her over the edge is this email that she receives from her high school sweetheart announcing that him and his wife have had a baby. That information just plunges her into an entirely different world of pain. And I think it's maddening for her to see somebody that she considers less than, who, you know, she felt that she had moved beyond him and become more successful than him. And now he has the audacity to be happy and to have a child. And she can't handle that.
Let's take it back to when she first arrives back in her hometown, Mercury, Minnesota. She goes in to buy a new dress.
Yes.
Right off, she's scheming to look really, really good. And let's play a clip from the movie. She's shopping for an outfit that she will meet Buddy in and talking to a saleswoman.
I'm going to a rock concert with an old flame. And I think there is a chance we may reconnect.
Let's show him what he's been missing.
No, he's seen me recently. He knows. But his wife hasn't seen me in a while, so.
Whoa. And the saleswoman backs off. And you do laugh, but also there's it's quite a cringe-inducing moment.
It is. I mean, it's why I loved writing this character so much, is because I noticed in so many conventional romantic comedies, the women are always getting flustered. It's like this cute thing, you know? And she never is. I mean, she's blatantly telling the saleswoman that she is trying to break up a marriage. She's just incredibly blunt And that is fun to write. That was cathartic.
One thing about this movie is that, at least at the beginning in the setup, it seems as if it almost could go in the direction of My Best Friend's Wedding.
Yeah.
With Julia Roberts, a big movie with Julia Roberts, where she wanted to get back her ex-boyfriend,
yeah,
steal him away from his fiancée before he gets married.
There definitely is like a mainstream romantic comedy version of this movie. And I wanted to kind of play with the ideas of the genre a little bit. You know, the idea of, we have seen movies before about the woman who wants to get the guy back, but the guy who's right for her is right in front of her. You know, it's this trope that we've seen a million times in films. And I thought, you know, what's a way that I can turn this on its ear and do something that's actually really dark and unexpected? So even though some of those elements are there, the way it plays out is very different than anything you've seen, I hope.
Well, one thing about her, she's a beautiful, physically beautiful person. It's Charlize Theron.
Yeah.
For Star-
She is really beautiful.
But a sort of ugly person at the same time.
Well, that's Charlize is incredible. And I mean, everybody knows that. She's already this celebrated actor. But what's incredible about her is, in this role, she had to find a way to make herself haggard just using her natural acting ability. Because when she was, for instance, when she was in the movie Monster, you know, she played a serial killer and she was amazing and she won an Oscar, but she also had gained weight and there was makeup involved. And so there was a physical transformation as well, whereas she wasn't able to use any of those tricks for this movie. And I think some people have said she's even scarier in Young Adult than she is in Monster. So that's a testament to how great of an actor she is.
Well, she's sort of the monster that we all might have known in high school.
Yes. She's the devil that you know, as the saying goes.
This must be a challenge, though, asking an audience to connect with a character who's unlikable.
It is a challenge, and it's something that throughout the process of writing the script, throughout the process of developing the film, I was nervous. You know, I thought to myself, are people going to accept it? I honestly had never seen anything like it before, except in certain instances with male leads. You know, I think we're more conditioned to accept a male curmudgeon or a male anti-hero, and so I was worried. And maybe I still have reason to be worried.
Well, you wrote a piece in Newsweek recently saying that you were annoyed when your husband said he sees a lot of Mavis in you.
I was surprised because, you know, he's seen everything I've written and he had never really said, oh, you remind me of that character you wrote. And then he saw Young Adult and said, oh, wow, like, finally, I'm seeing you. That's and I thought, oh, my God, I'm so insulted. Like, you know, Mavis is the most flawed character I've ever written and you think I'm like her. But then I realized it's not just me. It's kind of a generational thing. Like, I feel like I'm part of a generation of people who are stuck in the past and are really self-absorbed. I mean, we're actually taking pictures of ourselves and posting them on Facebook and keeping in touch with people that should have been out of our lives 15 years ago, obsessing over who's getting married, who's having kids, who's more successful. It's like we're recreating high school every single day using social media, and it's weird.
Diablo Cody, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Diablo Cody wrote the screenplay for the new movie, Young Adult. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. It's that time of year when best of lists are being drawn up and lovers of the English language come together to select the coolest word or phrase. Last year, we were talking about app, which was voted the word of the year by the American Dialect Society. Now, that group of etymologists, writers, historians, and other language experts is again calling for your nominations. Linguist Ben Zimmer is the chair of the new Words Committee and joined us to offer his picks for 2011. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ben, what is the top of your list?
Well, in terms of the word that I think is most likely to win, I would say it's occupy. That word has certainly been hard to avoid over the last few months. And it's really taken off in a surprising way, so that this word occupy, starting with Occupy Wall Street, has had a kind of a modular effect. You can occupy, fill in the blank, anything that you would like. There are even parodies of it, Occupy Sesame Street, Occupy My Couch, lots of different variations on the theme. And it's become so powerful that it has become a kind of a call to action in itself. It's an old word, of course, but it's been invested with lots of interesting new meanings.
And Another political movement has given the lexicon another new term that looks like it'll stay for a while, and that's Arab Spring.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, when we look back on this year, 2011, Arab Spring may really be the phrase that we remember. It's modeled on past expressions like Prague Spring of 1968, or even going all the way back to the 18th century with the springtime of nations with the revolutions in Europe. So this idea of spring being connected to popular uprisings, it has a long history to it, and that has become the label under which all of these activities in the different countries have been known and recognized. And so that is certainly, a powerful bit of language for the past year.
There were also some phrases coined this past year that poked fun at world leaders, and there was one world leader in particular who was very easy to make fun of.
I'm guessing you're talking about Italy's Silvio Berlusconi. He was done in by revelations of sex parties, and the label that was used for these sex parties was bunga bunga. And now that's quite an evocative and suggestive term, bunga bunga. It was a little mysterious exactly what might be referred to there. But as soon as bunga bunga got not just into the Italian press, but the English language press worldwide, people really picked up on that. And it was an easy way to make fun of Berlusconi's troubles as he was going down.
So what about pop culture?
Some of the diversions that we had this past year included Charlie Sheen at the beginning of the year having his rather bizarre public breakdown with his own special language that people picked up on. You may recall Winning, Tiger Blood, Adonis DNA, all of these Sheenisms that people started trading. Now, that has faded a bit. And one interesting thing, too, about Winning, as an example, is that one of its sources of its success, I think, was from Twitter. And this is true of Occupy and some other key terms from the past year. These single words can often get a special power on Twitter by being used as hashtags, where you use the hash sign followed by a word or phrase to identify what you're talking about. It could be a subject matter. It could be a little joke. But these hashtags actually end up having the power of slogans or mantras and really help to spread words and phrases in a popular way.
I know it must be hard to pick a favorite, Ben, but if you had a favorite, what would it be?
Well, a personal favorite of mine from the past year was humble brag. And that's a term that came up on Twitter, actually, in order to describe the kind of fake humility that we often see celebrities when they're tweeting and talking about how tough their lives are. They've got so many bathrooms in their mansion. And so the comedian Harris Whittles started up this term humble brag, which really nailed this particular type of pampered discourse on Twitter. And so it was a perfect little term to describe something new and funny that was happening this year.
Well, I'm sure listeners have many suggestions of their own, and you listeners can send your nominations for Word of the Year to WOTY@AmericanDialect.org. Ben, it's been good talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Linguist Ben Zimmer is the new language columnist for the Boston Globe.